Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you've not begun to prepare for the things that are to come, the things which are already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is February 27, 2011. Bill Fink and Kaiser are joining us for the first installment of the Valkyrie plot against Hitler and his Third Reich government. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh.
Yes, thanks.
Well, this is the this is from a book by Hermann Geisler, who was one of Hitler's architects, and he wrote a book entitled Another Hitler, and this series of articles is by Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann, and they're from translations of Geisler's work, right?
Now, the plots against Hitler, they go back for multiple decades, don't they? Easily into the 20s. And, of course, they weren't really serious back then. They were just basically thugs and communists that hated him because he was a white man standing up for his race. But the plots against him within the German military go back to the early and mid-30s, correct? That a lot of these status quo, conservative-type Prussian aristocratic generals did not like him.
Well, it seems like plots of substance against Hitler go back as far as 1938. And the first serious attempt on his life that came close was in 1939. There was another one in 1942, I believe. And then this one in 1943. And then this Valkyrie plot in 1944. The plots before that really had no substance.
So the main plots began in 38 that were actually serious.
Well, absolutely, and we're going to see that in the translator's introduction to this first article on the Valkyrie plot,
all right,
the final plot against Hitler, where they explain some of the earlier plots against him.
Would you like for me to begin?
Fine.
All right, Valkyrie, the final plot against Hitler. Hitler, Bormann, confide bomb plot details to Hermann Geisler at the Wolf's Lair. In their last two installments, the authors have told us of how Hitler confided to architect Hermann Geisler how he and Germany were being stabbed in the back by saboteurs and traitors. Specifically, Hitler claimed Soviet military leaders had advanced knowledge of German plans and that he believed the leaks were coming from high-level German sources. But this wasn't all these traitors were up to. A cabal of prominent German officers was working to blow Hitler to kingdom come with a briefcase bomb on July 20, 1944, while Hitler and dozens of other German officers were at the Führer's Wolfschanze headquarters. By some miracle of fate, the bomb did not kill Hitler, even though it tore apart the conference room and killed and maimed others. Although he did not sustain life-threatening injuries, Hitler's psyche was bruised when confronted with the deeply damaging extent of the treason. And interestingly enough, I just want to point out that had the Count von Stauffenberg actually felt so strongly about it, and he felt that Hitler had to die no matter what, he would have walked in there and shot him instead of planting a bomb and scurrying away like a coward. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you're right. The bomb, if you're really concerned about your nation, and you really have to remove somebody, and you feel that strongly about it, you're a coward for planting a bomb, yes. And
running
hoping
away.
It works. Absolutely.
He would have been a suicide bomber or a suicide shooter if he actually thought it had to be done.
Well, maybe he should have found Islam, right? And the 70 versions would have given him the impetus. It's a cowardly act to plant the bomb on a man and to run and hope it works. Hello?
Oh, sorry, yes. And this is by Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann. Do we know much about them?
No, I haven't prepared anything for them. I could have, I didn't.
All right. Translator's introduction. With the release of the Hollywood blockbuster movie Valkyrie, starring Tom Cruise, the public has been given a dramatization of the historic confrontation between two visions of Germany during a time of total war, that of the old military-industrial aristocracy versus that of the new National Socialist regime. While media mavens have made heroes of the members of the Valkyrie conspiracy, Hitler confidant and architect Hermann Geissler points out the substantial damage their plotting and communicating with the enemy did to the German war effort, costing many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of German lives. In this and the following articles in the Valkyrie series, you're shown the view from the other side, from the very command center of the struggle for the life of a nation. Many of the same men were involved in earlier assassination attempts in November 1939 and March 1943. There was even a plot in 1938 led by Lieutenant Colonel Hans Oster to prevent a military invasion of Czechoslovakia. Contacts with the British Foreign Office at that time led Undersecretary Robert Vansittart to comment, "But that is treachery." After the war, publication of an account of these contacts was forbidden in England. In 1939, anti-Nazi German Johann Georg Elser planted a bomb near the lectern at the November 8, 1923 Putsch anniversary dinner in Munich, but Hitler left early, escaping the explosion that left several dead and injured. And again, this is another coward. If he cared enough about this to get it done, he would have been there personally and done it personally, even at the loss of his own life. It's a cowardly man indeed that plants a bomb and skulks away. In 1942 and 1943, resistance member Helmuth James Graf von Moltke, great-nephew of the German general of the same surname, persisted in trying to arrange meetings in Stockholm with the British political warfare executive. It was blocked by Churchill. In this regard, it should be remembered that beginning in 1939, the Hitler government was itself sponsoring secret peace feelers and even detailed proposals to high British government officials. All were rejected. March 1943 saw two attempts to kill Hitler masterminded by General Henning von Treskow. The first was a bomb placed on Hitler's plane that failed to detonate. See Inside Hitler's Secret Headquarters, Part 2, The Barnes Review, May-June 2009. A week later, Treskow got Colonel Freiherr von Gersdorf to act as a suicide bomber at an exhibition Hitler would be attending. So this guy cares about it so much he enlists someone else as a suicide bomber. He wouldn't do it himself.
Yeah, it sounds like a Jewish tactic.
Find someone else to commit suicide at your behalf. With two 10-minute fuse bombs in his coat pockets, he was to get near to Hitler before they went off. But Hitler stayed only 8 minutes, leaving Gersdorf to run to the lavatory to defuse his bombs. Hitler repeatedly escaped harm, making it seem fate or providence was on his side. Much has been made of Hitler's supposed tantrums against his generals and other military staff. For example, over the Elbrus affair, see the Barnes Review, May-June 2009, and Halder's dismissal. But Geissler reports nothing like that. Adolf Hitler didn't chew the carpet or throw chairs around, but he did get angry. He seemed to have a reliable sense for loyalty, or lack of it, around him. It turns out that leading generals like Ludwig Beck, Günther von Kluge, Kurt von Hammerstein, Eckhard, and Erwin Witzleben, and even Walter von Brauditsch, were already in the mid-1930s expressing cynical remarks and doubts within their old Reichswehr circles. And wasn't the entire, it seems that the Reichswehr, certainly the Abwehr, was just full of people that had almost what we could call open contempt for Hitler, and yet they weren't purged. Whereas the Soviet Union, if you did anything other than applaud when Stalin was talking, your head's going to roll.
That's absolutely true. And let me say that this May-June 2009 article that's being referred to is also from Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann, and it's a two-part series that part one was actually in March-April 2009. It's called Inside Adolf Hitler's Secret Military Headquarters. It's also through the memoirs of Hermann Geissler. And we will cover it. I would have liked to have done it before this series. However, I don't have access to the entire article yet. I'm still trying to obtain it. The Yeah, you would ask about Jaeger and Mann, and Wilhelm Mann is a native German speaker and a World War II scholar, and he's the one that did the translation of Hermann Geisler's memoirs, and Another Hitler. And Carolyn Jaeger is a freelance writer and revisionist writer from Texas.
All right. These men were often from old aristocratic families with long military service. They felt resentment towards Hitler's strategic and tactical directives, often disagreed with his decisions, considering them interference with General Staff's established knowledge and wisdom. It should be noted that most of the conspirators were from the General Staff, not commanding officers in the field. What makes Geisler a rare source is his close relationship to Hitler. As someone whose company Hitler enjoyed, Geisler was often called to Führer headquarters to spend long evenings in discussion and drawing of city-building projects. This time he arrived at Wolf's Lair in East Prussia at the beginning of August to keep Geisler from asking questions of the Führer. Martin Bormann made all the investigatory reports of the conspiracy available to him. Geisler's account, in his own words, begins in Munich on that fateful day. Translator's notes rendered in italics. Would you like to take over from Geisler?
Geisler's recollections of the bombing. On the late afternoon of July 20th, 1944, my brother called me. Close your office, organize all your coworkers who have military training, and form a guard unit, if necessary, supply them with weapons. Geisler's brother was an army officer, right? Send the rest home and stay by your telephone. After you give the necessary orders, drive immediately to my office and by no means allow yourself to be stopped on your way, even by military police. Do you have a weapon? No, it may be better. I send a car and driver to pick you up. Your place now should be at my office. Geisler asks, what happened? The assassination of the Führer and the military is alarmed. Valkyrie has been unloosed in Berlin. The situation is still unclear. I can imagine they expected the assassination was successful, right? My brother, as an experienced company commander, secured his post and the immediate surrounding area. We then waited tensely for further news from Führer headquarters via the telegraph, from telephones, from the liaison office of the Wehrkreis, the military district, for messages from the party office, from the SS and the GAU. It was with great relief when finally, in the late evening, we heard the Führer's voice in Munich and the whole Wehrkreis, Wehrkreis 7, that's Military District 7. Everything was quiet. It remained that way as far as we could judge during the night. A week later, architect and minister of armaments Albert Speer, under time pressure, picked up Geisler on his way to Stuttgart so they could discuss war construction, the labor force, and steel quotas. We then talked, this is Geisler's words again, we then talked about July 20th. Speer had been at Führer headquarters and gave me his impressions of the fuller extent of the conspiracy. Worried, he said, even now after the assassination, the Führer is still very much involved with the military and political consequences. He needs some distance from the assassination attempt and all the disappointments. I believe that it's time that you arrive at headquarters, Geisler, as you are the only one who can distract him even for a few hours a day, present him with city-building plans, Linz and the Danube Bank construction that will still be of interest and lead him out of permanent worrying. I'm sure this was a huge distraction for Hitler at a crucial moment of the war, right? After a few days, the call came from Führer headquarters. Bormann was short. Please come as soon as possible. The Führer is expecting you. Please bring along all the plans that might interest him, naturally everything that refers to Linz. Full of excitement to see Hitler and talk to him, I arrived at Hitler headquarters, Wolfschanz, or the Wolf's Den or Lair. But what he told me confidentially during the following week and what I found out, as ordered by him from others, what I was reading in documents and protocols, and what I saw around me shattered me deeply. All that I learned, I would have thought impossible. It felt as unreal as spooks in the night. Now that controls had been introduced, I entered Sperrkreis, a restricted zone, one, to report to Hitler. I met him in front of his bunker talking to his adjutant. Actually, Hitler made a few steps toward me. I expected you, and I'm glad to see you. He shook my hand, guarding his right arm, which was bent and held in a sling, and his right leg also obviously hurting. The side of his face that was toward the explosion was slightly swollen. I'm sorry. He had cotton in his ears, but I was surprised by his posture. I thought it would be worse. At tea time, to which he had invited me, he mentioned the assassination only briefly and spoke little about his injuries. Linge, his servant, showed me Hitler's coat and the torn trousers, which were split lengthwise, like the ones worn by medieval mercenary soldiers. They did check you, Geisler. Understand that. It is an order for the time being caused by the assassination. In the future, it will not be done with you. I didn't agree. After all that happened here, I thought the control was naturally necessary. It could have been that someone put something into my briefcase. No, Hitler said, check for yourself before you cross the checkpoints. Apparently, he gave the orders because any checking in the future didn't happen. As late as autumn, as well as January, February 1945, in the command bunker at the Reich Chancellery, I always, however, checked my own briefcase and blueprints. On the first evening, we talked about city construction in Linz and Munich. For me, it was an unexpected and rare conversation during days of turbulent military and political events. At the beginning, Hitler looked deflated, but in the course of our discussion, he became visibly more energetic and open-minded. The Kaltenbrunner reports. The next morning, Bormann asked me to see him, giving me this advice. Please don't put any questions to the Führer about July 20th, meaning the day of the assassination attempt, and all that was connected with it, unless he himself talks about it. Try, however, to distract him, talk with him primarily about Linz. That's what interests him most. On the other hand, I think it proper that you be informed correctly about all the happenings of July 20th. I will see to it that you will be informed about every detail of the deep web. After a short pause, one happening is under absolute secrecy. The Führer will decide if you are to have knowledge about it, but I urgently ask, don't approach Hitler on that matter. However, I could see all the supporting documents and interview protocols delivered by Kaltenbrunner to Bormann's office. By getting an overview of the total network of the clique of traitors and the larger circle of people involved, I would be more likely to refrain from asking Hitler about the affair during our discussions. Only later was it clear to me what Bormann really meant by that. From then on, in the morning hours and during the lodge meetings, I was primarily in Bormann's office. At those times, he pulled out of the vault the reports, the interview protocols, and lists of persons and investigations, which are known today as the Kaltenbrunner reports. But those documents were only a part, even though a very important one, of the entire web of high treason. I sat down in the corner of his office and began reading the sober reports of conspiracy, which already began pre-war, before the war, and gradually increased in strength until it developed into a perfect form, betraying, above all, the struggling front line and killing hundreds of thousands of soldiers. The often dissonant-sounding remarks of Hitler since 1939, quote, I have the feeling of being surrounded by treason, unquote, his former hints as on November 6, 1939, middle January 1940, then during Weserübung, the Norway campaign, at the end of the French campaign, adding in the partly depressing, partly angry reactions as I experienced them at Winisa in 1942 and Wolfschanze in 1943, now by these reports and protocols, his suspicion was confirmed. But far more than that, happenings up to now, unexplainable, became transparent and finally made sense, worse than ever imagined. I began with the reading of the prepared appeals to the armed forces and the German people. Gordeler to the armed forces, quote, something additional threatens to deprive you of the success of your victories, which you gained from a leadership of educated and experienced men. Hitler's strategic genius, which he claimed in an irrational delusion and was disgustingly idolized by his lackeys. Another appeal still better, the Führer is dead, an immoral clique of battle-ignorant party leaders misusing the present situation is trying to take over the government for selfish reasons, stabbing the fighting troops in their back. With that, Field Marshal von Witzleben, wanted to address the German people and the armed forces to introduce himself as the new Supreme Commander. I knew him then, still fresh from the glory of crossed Marshal batons. At the People's Court, they took pictures when he denied having any knowledge of the assassination and the military conspiracy, which was immediately refuted. When questioned, well, what were your thoughts then as to what was going to happen if the assassination would have succeeded? He answered, I am a military. I don't know anything about political and civilian matters. In the second part of the sentence, he sounded absolutely convincing. The next documents were photocopies, kind of an operational plan of the putsch government, and a list of the ministers selected for the Reichskanzler, Federal Chancellor Gordeler. On both documents, Speer was listed as minister with a question mark. However, surprised, I jumped up and went to Bormann. What does that mean? That's not possible. Bormann looked up Conrad Gisler on the matter. Everything is possible. Slowly he stood up, went to the vault, took out a voluminous file, opened it, and showed me the top seat. There was the name, Speer, only that for your personal information, he said, and returned the file to the vault. Keep silent about all that, he said, sitting down at his desk. That was enough for that day. I could not continue reading. Geisler reflects on the role of Speer. My thoughts went back to a talk with Karl Hanke, Gauleiter of Silesia. A war construction site in Lower Silesia caused me to meet him several times in March 1944. In my judgment, he was a man full of character, with wise, attentive eyes and a well-shaped head. Hanke proved himself during the political battles in Berlin and later as a soldier at the front. His clear formulations corresponded with his long activities as an undersecretary of state at Dr. Goebbels' office. One evening in Salzbrunn, Hanke asked me to advise him after the war with his plans for city rebuilding and solutions for traffic problems at Breslau, the capital of Silesia. Well, I said to him, aren't you closely associated with Speer? If I agree to fulfill your request, apart from being overloaded with my own work, it would be an affront against him, which I don't want to happen. Up until then, Speer could not even overlook the fact that I got the Munich assignment, and then, in addition, Linz. My job as an architect included, with the exception of Weimar, most of the southwestern region of Germany. But you also advise Mayor Freiberg in Leipzig. Yes, I answered, only because of the Führer's order when problems at the fair, Leipzig's annual international trade fair, arose in connection with the planned extension of the railway system. That was one more reason for him to talk to the Führer. For various reasons, he wanted me and not Speer as an advisor for Breslau. He had a very clear opinion of Speer's goals, knowing what's going on in his office, that worried him and did not sit well. The Führer should know about it. His particular mistrust extended to two of Speer's closest co-workers. Hanke mentioned the names. I knew both of them, one highly ranked in the SA, the other in the SS. Do you know that Speer is after succeeding Hitler? Yes, I had heard about it, but I considered it gossip, as an incorrect and overbearing opinion of Speer's personality by his staff. Here, wish might be the father of the thought. No, contradicted Hanka. There is more to it. He doesn't want to burden me with that stuff, but the Fuhrer should know about it. He, however, cannot get an appointment. Bormann is completely shielding Hitler, isolates him from everything that worries him also. I could, and there's an ellipsis, the quote is not finished. The protection by Bormann is Hitler's order, I interrupted him, and Hitler considers me only as his architect and would strongly object if I would dare to get mixed up in matters that are none of my business. Please understand that. You're right, I have tried to talk by myself. I have to try by myself to talk to the Fuhrer, the words of Hanka. Remembering that talk with Hanka, his critique of Speer and Speer's two co-workers made me pensive. But how is Speer's attitude after the July 20th assassination to be explained when he expressed to me his deep worry about Hitler and when he asked me to take the Linz plans with me to the Fuhrer headquarters? Other small events before the assassination, unimportant as they were then, seem to me now rather strange. John, can you fill us in on Speer's role in this? Do you have an encapsulation of it? Or?
No,
I'm sorry
I can't.
To catch you by surprise. I'm just curious.
All right.
I mean, I'm sure we'll get the long story over the presentation.
Right, exactly. That's what it seemed like to me.
At the end of June 1944, for instance, Speer called the leaders of the defense industry, the armament industry, and the directors of the building industry to Linz and urged their utmost effort to increase the production of the armament industry. That Linzer convention ended with Hitler's speech at the Platterhof at the Obersalzberg. Speer and I were Hitler's guests that evening at the Berghof. After dinner, Speer said with urgency, Geisler, by all means, find a moment to tell Hitler about the Linz Convention and let him know that I ended it with the performance of Bruckner's Fourth Symphony at the Aula of the St. Florian Abbey. Speer knew how much Hitler liked that symphony. Like that evening, he suggested, my Führer, I propose that Geisler should tell some funny anecdotes. With Speer, everything was practical and calculated. Even as a friend, I considered him a stranger full of riddles. Now his name appeared, though with a question mark, on the list of ministers of the traitors. In the evening, Hitler talked to me about his successor. Was it a coincidence, or was it a hint by Bormann caused by my reaction in the morning? Hitler said, after this terrible war, the only one who is privileged to appear in front of the nation is he who, as a soldier, risked his life and justified it with his bravery and willingness to sacrifice. Naturally, he has to show the quality of a leader and charisma. He has to be wise and think logically, and above all, however, he has to have character. Only a brave soldier of that war has the right to lead the nation. Then he was silent for a long time. Next morning, I was sitting again in the corner of Bormann's office and reading more messages, reports, documents. No further mention of Speer. There's a translator's note here. For more on Geisler's recollections of Bormann, please see the item at the bottom of page 16, which Geisler goes into great detail about Hitler's second-in-command. We will get there. The People's Court. The reports and interrogations got more and more complicated. One peculiar incident of the interrogation of Theodor Strunk, for instance, impressed me quite a bit. He called Admiral Canaris. Canaris was in charge of Germany's intelligence efforts.
He was the biggest traitor probably of them all.
Yes. He called Admiral Canaris shameless because at Strunk's interrogation, Canaris requested that he put everything on Oster and Donani. During the evening hours, primarily around, so actually Canaris is even in betraying the people that were in on a plot with him, right? During the evening hours, primarily around the time the Laga took place, the first film clips of the trial at the People's Court were shown. I did not want to miss anything and looked at the film for a while. Some of the accused I knew personally, of the others I had formed impressions from reading the protocols, which the films now complete. Hoppner, von Witzleben, Steiff, how much they differed from the young officers like Clausing and Bernardis. These admitted their deeds with military composure and yet still wanted to distance themselves. Well, if the younger ones would only have known what a miserable attitude dominated the plotters' heads. I saw the counterposition of Major von Leonrad with his confessor priest, Father Worley, and listened to their terrifying discussion. I felt my way to the door and avoided further films. One evening, for one reason or another, Hitler talked about the 20th of July. I told him I had seen some films of the trials at the People's Court, and I was shattered. Hitler remarked, quote, "I don't want to see anything of that. It is enough that I have to read the reports." The assassination revealed very clearly to me that not only high treason, but also the ugly Landsverrat lost its disguise. For a long time, I had suspected treason. In Winiza, I felt it directly. Often I thought I felt physically furtive glances, but much more, far beyond what has been reported, I have now learned after a sober consideration, I think it's proper to be silent for the sake of the fighting troops and the unity of the nation.
That reaction, you mentioned that Hitler didn't want to even see the trial footage. The History Channel documentaries claim that he had the executions videotaped so he could watch them for his own amusement.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
They don't offer any evidence of that, though. They just claim that Hitler wanted to see video footage of the men being hanged.
Well, yeah, well...
Sounds like something Stalin would do.
Exactly. You know, it seems like the big theme in all of this betrayal of Hitler, a lot of it emanates from the intelligence agencies within the Reich itself.
Well, absolutely, and Canaris was right at the head of it. It seems like they were all in the pocket of the British Foreign Office.
I have, Irving's book about their betrayal in the West, D-Day, there is some really damning information about that could have that really affected the Normandy landings. It would have had a possible disastrous effect on Allied invasion. Now, if later on we'll get into that, but it's some really damaging information, and it has to do with the German intelligence agency.
That reactionary clique plotted since 1938, if not earlier, for my fall by revolt or assassination. But it was not in accordance with their character to confront me openly with a weapon, as Brian was talking about earlier. They're all cowards. How they must have hated me and National Socialism when they betrayed without scruple and so miserably even the fighting troops. The whole scope of that shameful plot one can now see. It is so revolting. Rattenhuber and Hogel will tell you some of it. However, keep it confidential. I've bound everyone who knew about it to silence, and that also includes you. So, as you were explaining, Brian, that the antithesis of this would be Stalin's action in the Soviet Union, where every slight was seen as a great offense. And there were public hangings, and they would trumpet it in the media, and here there is to make examples, right? And here on July 20th, Hitler is quiet and is just trying to smooth things over for the morale of the nation. He doesn't operate on a pretense of instilling fear in the hearts of his subjects, right?
Absolutely, and Stalin was personally present, I believe, at Yagoda's execution and at Yezhov's execution, and both of those men cried for mercy and begged for mercy, and they were shot anyway. But I find that kind of interesting that Yagoda would beg for mercy when he's doubtlessly killed hundreds of thousands without mercy.
Okay, Hermann Geisler remembers Martin Bormann. I didn't only read reports, I also watched what was going on at Martin Bormann's desk and his method of work. I gained new insight into the character of that powerful man, feared by many and even hated as the party's gray eminence. During that period, he appeared to me more transparent and more understandable than in previous years. I will describe him as I saw him. here he was sitting, this so bedeviled man, with his shirt sleeves rolled up during the summer heat, with lively alertness and immense industriousness. He worked through piles of files, dictated and phoned without a break. He had the endurance of a fighting bull. I think Adolf Hitler saw him correctly when he once told me, quote, Bormann is like his signature, and that is like the Hohhead Gowel, or a high mountain peak near the Berghof, Hitler's home. I probably destroyed the pronunciation of that. I was often present at the time when Bormann reported to Hitler. He did so in a matter-of-fact and concentrated way, with all the pros and cons, mostly about very important matters. Sometimes when persons and happenings were involved that I was familiar with, I could see how clearly and correctly it had been reported. Then Adolf Hitler decided it. That information given to the Fuhrer covered all areas of the state, the party, and the whole civil sector, and lasted sometimes hours. I was drawing while this went on, but still listened carefully. An adjutant would appear, reporting the Lage or an interruption because of an established appointment. Then Hitler will say, Geisler will continue later on. Or Bormann, seated at Geisler, get some refreshments. A little later, I was again sitting in my corner, refreshments there, reading the reports or silently watching Bormann at work. He often dictated to two or three secretaries at a time. But, rather strange and surprising, at the same time that Bormann dictated to give the gist of the matter, he memorized Hitler's decisions word for word, following the sentences exactly as they were spoken by Hitler, while in between he shaped the letters and orders that he derived from them. Telephone calls came in, disturbing messages were handed to him, after which he continued dictating where he had stopped before. Again a call came. Bormann looked at me, the Lage is over, the Fuhrer expects you, and turned again to his work. Who could endure that, day in and day out, always deep into the night, and for years? Indeed, Bormann was like the Hohe Goel, that high mountain. And like that Goel, he sometimes cast a shadow in bright light. Naturally, he cast shadows. Sometimes I had real quarrels with him, or he with me. Twice Hitler intervened, Geisler, please go along with Bormann. Once at the Berghof in the spring of 1944, he said to me, Geisler, if you want to drive away from here early, mad because of Bormann, but you are Mrs. Bormann's guest and you are also my guest, no, you cannot do that to us. By the way, let it be said to you, in that case, Bormann acted absolutely correctly. He naturally should have given you some explanation, which I herewith do now. We'll see. Geisler, I need Bormann and his working strength. He relieves me. He is steady, unshakable, and an achiever. I can depend on him. Hitler's words about Bormann. In retrospect, I always found out on my own that Bormann was correct to get tough on me, or that he acted on Hitler's order. Bormann noticed everything. It reflected his former job as an estate administrator. I accompanied him once on an inspection trip at a small farm that supplied the Obersalzberg. He checked out everything down to the champignons, the mushroom cellar. Nothing missed his eyes. Then we climbed into the forest above the Berghof. There he showed me his animal world in its free natural surroundings. An owl was there, a squirrel. What else was jumping around there? I cannot remember. He allowed beehives to be brought into the Hohe Goel when the trees were blooming. He got enthusiastic about that magnificent mountain. Dr. Tott had personally searched for that high track and marked it through the sheer rocks. It is the most beautiful and daring road I know of by far. I hold Dr. Tott in high esteem and still think about him often, Bormann said. On the way back, turning off the road, he looked around and asked how I liked it. I remarked, one has a beautiful view from here all around. It's beautiful up here. Yes, a good location, Bormann said. Connection with the street, which in winter is cleared from snow. A well is close by. You are going to be settled here after the war, so you are present for the Fuhrer at any time. Bormann was choosing out a place to live for Geisler, evidently. Striding on, he whistled. Alla mi presente al vostro signori, an old lanzknecht song. It is translated, O you men, prepare yourselves for muster. During the difficult days in August 1944, when a disloyalty and treason were apparent, Bormann said to me with a serious meaning, I have one task and one goal, and that is to serve the Führer as a National Socialist. My only ambition is to do that as well as I am able. The Führer gives me the authority that I need to do it. I activate it, but solely for this, my task. Certainly you have no doubts that I am totally obligated to the Führer. I don't want anything else but to take some of the heavy burden off of his shoulders, and that is not easy. And Geisler believed him. So Bormann is portrayed as the extremely intelligent, very acute, and ever-caring servant to Adolf Hitler.
You know, some modern historian revisionist freaks, they try and claim that Bormann and Hitler were gay lovers. So anytime two men in history are friends, they have to be gay lovers. There's no such thing as male friendship.
Well, that's the way Jews think, isn't it? That they project themselves on everybody. They think the worst of everybody. These people that we have infiltrated throughout our entire society are decadent. They have perverted minds, and they project that on everybody, just like the typical American Anglo-Saxon projects his ideals on the other races and feels that they should be as civilized as we are. The Jew protects his ideals on everybody and feels that they should be as decadent as he is.
So basically the typical white American thinks that everybody values justice, freedom, and fairness, and that's not the case.
Exactly. And the Jew thinks that everybody values pornography, decadence, dishonesty, and seediness, and everything else that's perverted.
And that the main goals in life are money and sex.
When I was reading ahead for this series, I mean, we're not done here yet, right? I'd like to read three pages from David Irving, The Silent Swabian, and I'm really, this is a partial setup for next week. It's obvious that I have to do some research about Albert Speer. This first part of this Valkyrie plot has raised some questions about him that we should definitely answer, but there's a figure that caught my attention, and I would like to begin on him, because I want to talk about him at greater length later in this series. And that figure is General Speidel, right? And Speidel was actually he was working for Rommel, and Rommel was in charge of the defending the Atlantic coast. And it seems that Speidel had become Rommel's chief aide, and he was a traitor to Hitler and to Nazi Germany. And it seems that I think that the mainstream sources are really downplaying Speidel's role in the betrayal of Germany at the Normandy invasion. And David Irving says a few good things about him, and a few revealing things about him, I should say. And I'd like to read the first three pages of from David Irving's book, The Trail of the Fox, The Search for the True Field Marshal Rommel by David Irving, from a chapter entitled The Silent Swabian. That's all about Speidel.
Interesting enough, you said that he later became a NATO general.
Yes, Speidel, after the war, was greatly rewarded with a new career working for NATO. And I think that there's a lot to that that the mainstream sources like Wikipedia are downplaying. I know John might have some things to say about this, but I'd like to read the first three pages from this chapter now. And we'll get into Speidel more later, and we'll get into Canaris more later also, because he's a chief figure in the betrayal of Germany and Germany's loss of the war. Yes,
right,
John.
Yeah. Bill, I'll tell you why Speidel was promoted or rewarded, and just right after you read this.
Okay, this is the first three chapters of The Silent Swabian, David Irving, from page 481 of his book on Rommel, The Trail of the Fox. Mid-April 1944, after weeks of dry weather, the rains have come to France. Rommel stands at the windows of his chateau room and wonders how many more weeks he has left to prepare for the biggest battle of his life. All Germany depends on him. Hitler has said so. They knew that there was going to be an invasion. Late on the 15th, an army car drives through the tall wrought iron gates and squelches to a halt at the main door. An unfamiliar officer climbs out into the rain. His bags are carried inside the chateau to the turret room that is to be his quarters, and he reports to the field marshal. He is Lieutenant General Speidel. His new chief of staff, Rommel, had made the difficult decision a month earlier to release Alfred Dausa, who has shared so much of his destiny since July 1941. He values and trusts Gauss, as I'll pronounce it probably incorrectly. But during his furlough at Herlingen, the general and his wife fell out with Lucy. Lucy is Rommel's wife, in the blameless way that house guests often do. Gauss had once rebuked Hermann Aldinger for arriving late for work in the garden, and Lucy had found Frau Gauss getting on her nerves. Eventually, Lucy actually demanded that Rommel replace Gauss as his chief of staff. So this was all done for his wife. And the field marshal meekly complied, writing her on March 17th, "Let's draw a line underneath it all. I am going to. Perhaps Gauss will find another post. Of course, it's a tough decision for me to have to change my chief at a time like this." Rommel had now written privately to Schmunt, asking him to give Gauss the next available Panzer Division to command. Gauss's successor is no ordinary general. At Hans Speidel's throat, Rommel glimpses the Knight's Cross that Hitler had just personally given him for the 8th Army's heroic fighting retreat on the Russian front. He probably remembers Speidel as the silent fellow Swabian he met in 1915 in the Argonne Forest, and again between the wars in the 13th Württemberg Infantry Regiment. Speidel was one of the two replacements offered to him by the general staff with the highest recommendations. Rommel has, as usual, picked the Swabian. Swabia is that southwest corner of Germany known as Baden-Württemberg.
Rommel Württemberg?
Yes, he was. That's why he picked that. Irving's conjecture is that Rommel picked the Swabian because he himself was a Swabian. My great-grandmother was also a Swabian. At 46, the newcomer is 6 years younger than Rommel. The field marshal finds this owlish, bespectacled general with his excellent history degree and polished manners a congenial change and a useful complement to his own one-track mind. He is academic, prudent, aesthetic, and music-loving. Rommel writes to his wife on April 16th, "He makes a good, fresh impression. I think I'm going to get on well with him." Indirectly, Erwin and Lucy Rommel had between them signed the field marshal's own death warrant in replacing Gauss with Speidel. By April 1944, Speidel was a general with a secret and something of a past as well. He had been involved ever since Stalingrad in the plans of the opponents to Hitler. It is a fair guess that the anti-Hitler members of the German of the general staff had assigned him to Rommel only for this reason. Only one day before his arrival here, he discussed with Strolin, the mayor of Stuttgart, the need to lure Rommel into the plot. Rommel suspected none of this, as he himself wrote in a remarkable private letter months later to Hitler. He trusted Speidel implicitly, frequently leaving him at the chateau to mind the store while he went forward to tour the coastal sectors. Jodl had pleaded with Speidel at the Berghof to boost Rommel's morale. Do what you can to cure him of his bouts of pessimism. He suffered from them ever since Africa. There is more than enough evidence, both in his own writings and in Rommel's letters home, to prove that Speidel did quite the reverse. He brought immediate dark tidings about the disastrous situation on the Russian front, where the two southern army groups were in full retreat and the Crimea had been lost. The mood in Rommel's diary changed from the very day of the general's arrival. What will later, and this is from Rommel's diary, what will later historians have to say about these retreats? And what will history say in passing the verdict on me? If I am successful here, then everybody else will claim the glory, just as they are already claiming the credit for the defenses and the beach obstacles that I have erected. But if I fail here, then everybody will be after my blood. At his forest home south of Munich, Eberhard Wolfram, a major on Rommel's personal staff, graphically described to me Speidel's gloomy influence on the field marshal's communal mealtimes. In Rommel's absence, Speidel took over the table, and his whole conversation revolved only around, quote, that asshole at the Berghof, meaning Hitler. So Speidel was not concealed about his hatred for Hitler, was he?
No. What if you called Stalin a jerk?
Yeah, you'd probably the local party apparatchik would have ratted on you, and you'd have gone straight to the gallows.
The NKVD would shoot you. Best case scenario, you go to a gulag in Siberia.
When I arrived, the mood of these table discussions was one of abject defeatism, except when Rommel came in. Then the tenor of the discussion changed. Nobody dared go so far with their defeatist remarks. During these short months of their association, Speidel gained an intellectual grip on the simple, plain-speaking soldier, meaning Rommel. Rommel stood in obvious awe of him. Once he sent Helmuth Lang to fetch Speidel, and the general told Lang, "I'll come when I'm ready," an attitude that Gauss would never have dared adopt. Speidel became known at the chateau for his phlegm and tranquility. In a private letter, Lang described a further incident on June 18, 1944. Quote, "I had the radio on in my anteroom playing Beethoven's Ninth rather loudly. The door was flung open, and Rommel asked me to switch off that awful noise. I switched it off only to hear the same music coming even louder from Speidel's room. Rommel shrugged and went back to his study to suffer Beethoven without further protest." A second factor, as unknown to Rommel as the disastrous Enigma leak had been, also dominated his fortunes from now on. An intricate and ingenious Allied deception plan, codenamed Fortitude, had begun. Its objects were to suggest that the invasion was due as early as May and that it would hit the Strait of Dover in the 15th Army sector. Even without Speidel, Rommel would have had little chance of seeing through the deception, for Hitler's intelligence services were well infiltrated with anti-Hitler men. In other words, if Germany could find out what Britain was up to, they wouldn't find out what Britain was up to. Rommel's own intelligence officer was an honest, mild-mannered army colonel, Antoine Staubwasser, assigned to Rommel because he was an intelligence expert on Britain. Staubwasser had some clerks and two interpreters, but no intelligence sources of his own. He had to rely on data furnished by the general staff's Foreign Armies West Branch, whose chief was later hanged by the Nazis as a member of the anti-Hitler conspiracy, and by Rundstedt's much bigger staff. There was virtually no air reconnaissance over England because of the Luftwaffe's weakness. Thus, the Fortitude planners had a pushover. They fed false reports to Hitler's intelligence networks that the invasion was imminent. Long before necessary, the British government began stopping or censoring mail and prohibited even foreign diplomats from leaving, although one, a Swede, was allowed to slip through. Civilian travel was restricted. Public buildings were requisitioned as hospitals. A premature bombing offensive began against the German railroads, non-existent American forces were, quote-unquote, moved into southeastern England, facing Soult's 15th Army by faking radio traffic and reports to German agents. Only Adolf Hitler, quote, the asshole at the Berghof, unquote, smelled a rat. On April 6th, Hitler said to Jodl, the only way that the British are serving all of this up to us, it looks, the whole way that the British are serving all of this up to us, it looks phony. This latest news about the restrictions they are ordering, the security clampdown, and so on. Now, you don't normally go in for all that if you're really up to something. I can't help feeling that the whole thing's going to turn out to be a shameless charade. When Hitler was informed of the quote-unquote troop movements detected towards southeast England, he grunted. Now what I ask myself is this. Why make such a song and dance about it? We wouldn't, I guarantee you, and they don't need to either, do they? They could perfectly well marshal their forces over here in the southeast, then load them on board ship and ship them over to here, Normandy. We've no real way of finding out what they're really up to over there. So it seems like Hitler knew that they really weren't going to go across the Strait of Dover, that they were going to Normandy. We've no real way of finding out what they're really up to over there. A few minutes later, Hitler announced, I'm in favor of pushing all of our forces into here. And he pointed to the Normandy coastline. Rommel's next inspection trip, however, from April 17th to 19th, went not to Normandy, but again to the 15th Army. This time, he took Speidel. Two other cars were filled with his staff, war reporters, and accordions to be handed out to the hardest workers. He liked to drop in on a lower echelons unawares. One sentry was so flustered by the field marshal's appearance that he stuttered, Jawohl, Herr Major, to him. Everywhere the very landscape was changing shape according to Rommel's orders. The fields were heaped with stone cairns or bristled with stakes and poles to keep gliders from landing. The beaches were jungles of barbed wire with wooden beams, concrete artifacts, and mines. Everywhere were the skull and crossbone signs, warning of minefields. Whether fake or real, even Rommel could not tell. Of course, there were still infuriating errors. Junior officers had seen fit to countermand some of Rommel's orders. Again, in Soviet Russia, it had gone right to the gulag. Cows were still permitted to graze in some of the dummy minefields. Secret fortifications built in the green meadow were camouflaged with old black netting. Rommel drafted a 22-page manual for all his commanders, summarizing all his practical hints. He sent a copy to Hitler, too, and Schmunt wrote back with the Führer's congratulations. He, too, was a practical man, Schmunt said. Now, the demonstration of all this is how poor were Germany's forewarnings, because Germany's intelligence agents had sold Germany out. Germany's own intelligence community had sold Germany out, and Germany really didn't know what Britain was up to. And even when Hitler thought that the battle was going to be at Normandy, that's where the British should land, and that's where they ultimately did, as we all know, they were preparing the area where Britain was advertising that the invasion would be. And Germany had no intelligence whatsoever.
Well, actually, so, that's not entirely true. The German intelligence did find out not only when they were landing, within 2 weeks of it, but actually within a few days, and also where they were going to land. It's just that there were some traitors that were supposed to warn the lower echelon units, the 7th Army in Normandy, that they were about to land there, and they didn't get the information.
And as we'll find out later, Speidel held up panzer groups from assisting in Normandy.
Oh, well, yeah, that's another detail. There was an argument between the panzer generals, including Guderian, and Rommel about where to place the panzers, but that's a separate argument. But that there's no traitor's intent in that.
Well, you might. I would think that there. We'll see it hopefully next week as we continue, but I would think that there probably was traitorous intent in that. It might be a matter of arguing over strategy now in hindsight, but the place to stop the invasion is on the beach, where the enemy's exposed. That's the way I look at it.
That's
my opinion, though.
That's what Rommel thought, and so did Hitler think that. Hitler wanted to defend every inch of soil anyway, even if you're surrounded and out of supplies. But
when you look at the mechanics of the invasion, that the invading army is most vulnerable transferring onto that beach.
Right. Well, let me just read a little something here, now that we're on this topic. This is all this intelligence information that German intelligence gathered. It says, how was it? This is on page 362 of the Trail of the Fox. And how was it possible that the German commanders could have been oblivious to the fate about to befall them? The answer to this reveals a deeper puzzle yet. German intelligence had given General Speidel strong evidence that the invasion would take place on June 6th, but he had declined to alert the 7th Army. And so that's why he was rewarded with the head of the NATO forces.
Well, absolutely. I would agree, but I think there was probably a lot more treachery than that. But, yeah, that would be an obvious reason, right? Very good.
That would be a smoking gun right there. So he doomed hundreds of thousands of soldiers to a certain death.
Right.
And his own nation to a certain defeat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, it's a wonder why Rommel couldn't have seen through this. He was a far simpler man. He expected, just like the average people today, we expect our coworkers or the people we work with to be of the same mind or close to it.
You don't expect someone on the team to work to sabotage the team.
Right.
You expect them to advance the goals and advance the objectives of the team or the organization.
Yeah, it was interesting how they found out where the Allies were going to land. It was through the French resistance cells. They were able to determine by their activation and their code, the code words they were using to activate them, where and when the landings would take place. And it was traitors within the intelligence that allowed them to not pass this on to the lower echelon units.
Well, there's one more paragraph I would like to read from a little further on in Irving's, from page 490 of this book, where it says that in this part of France, the upper classes were decidedly pro-German, fearing the consequences of communism over Europe, and the populace largely followed their lead. And of course, there was the ancient antagonism in these parts to Britain. Rommel was able to travel freely without a bodyguard. And Irving reveals there that in his own mind, this is his own commentary, he knew that the choice in World War II was really between Nazi Germany and Soviet communism, right? And the French understood that. We'll probably get into that a little later. Again, we've been there before, but it's nice to see it's nice to see mainstream historians explain it, right?
Well, there was a Marquis de Choisy that Rommel was personal friends with, and he was afterwards, he understood, just like you said, that it was the choice between communism and National Socialism, and he was, after the war, he was hanged by de Gaulle.
And look at Europe today. I mean, communism won. And France is overrun with Muslims.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, what Hitler said, that they will wipe us out to the last man, woman, and child, and that plan is slowly but going into effect right now.
Well, absolutely. But in the end, we're going to win. Exactly. We have God on our side. That's just the way it is. Okay, next week we'll be back with more on Canaris and Speidel and Speer I enjoy doing this because it's setting the record straight about why Germany lost the war and whose side who was on, Germany did not lose the war because Adolf Hitler was some narrow-minded, petty tyrant that forced his men to do things against the interests of the nation.
Idiots out there shouting, Hitler was a moron, he was a rank amateur, he did this, he threw tantrums, and of course the media is going to portray him that way, but that's not the reality of the situation.
Absolutely. The Jews love to portray him like that, and white nationalists and Christian identities, and they get tied up. That they don't realize how much Jewish propaganda they have in their heads.
Right. You know, Hitler had many and long arguments with his generals about things. Things that Stalin and the other people would never tolerate.
Absolutely not. Stalin would just order them off to the gulag, take them out back and shoot them in the head.
As Khrushchev said, if Stalin says dance, you dance.
Okay, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. Next week then, gentlemen. Thank you.